Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Heredity podcast. I'm Mike Poynter. For this episode, I'm very glad to be joined by Kok van Oosterhout, Professor of Evolutionary Genetics at the University of East Anglia. His work takes in a lot of areas, but today we're focusing on his interest in integrating genomic data into conservation, and particularly on an opinion piece that he recently wrote for Heredity. Hi Kok, thanks for coming on. An opinion piece, right? Is that how you think about it?
I guess it is in perspectives or an opinion piece. That's right.
And that was inspired by a recent paper in Science. So could you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, so this paper was by Aaron Wilder and a large group in America led by Beth Shapiro. And they did a fantastic analysis on 240 mammal species from the Zoonomia project. They had a single reference sequence for each of these individuals, and these individuals were different red list statuses, so from least concern to critically endangered. So they had a broad range of threat categories in this IUCN red list. And then what they aimed to do is to see, can they use this genomic data, this reference genome, to predict the red list status of these species? So they did. They made a machine learning model, training that to see, can we use this genomic data to make those type of predictions without any of the ecological data and all the other kind of demographic data that the red list is actually using to make these assessments. So the red list has these kind of five categories they use for listing species, category A to E. And those are typically kind of ecological or population-based values like population size or the range or whether the population is increasing or decreasing or stable. So these are kind of real things that you can see when you work with those species on the ground. But for a lot of species, this data is just not available. The red list has now just over 150,000 species evaluated, and there are about 2 million or so eukaryote species alive on Earth now. So there's a big job still to do. And the rationale is, well, if we can now use this reference genome data, which is being generated by hundreds of different groups all over the world in the Earth Biogenome Project and lots of other projects, people are generating high quality reference genomes. If you can now use those data to make predictions about the red list category or about the extinction probability, then that would really be a much faster and taxonomically unbiased way to evaluate species extinction risk. So that's kind of the motivation of this paper. And they then try to use these genomic data to predict what the red list status would have been. And they found a little bit disappointingly that actually the genomic data, yeah, it contained some information and was basically better than just random noise, but actually it wasn't as good as they'd hoped. And perhaps this is not so surprising because we know that that there's a very weak link between genomic data and the genetic variation and the genetic load and the red list status from other papers. And the reason is really that genomic data is often lacking behind in the actual demographic signal. So a population can go through a bottleneck. And before you can actually start to pick up those signals in genome data, it takes a few generations. And this kind of, we call it a drift debt, basically. It's kind of like delay, evolutionary delay, before all these allele frequencies start to change and the genotype frequencies start to change. Before you can actually start to pick that up in a single reference genome, you need to look several generations after the demographic event. So it's perhaps not the best way of assessing the current threats. But what genomic data can do, it can actually inform what has happened in the past, because all that information is actually contained in reference genome data. You can look at the coalescence of alleles, and you can look at how large population size used to be in the past. And you can use that information to predict what may happen in the future. And you can do that by using computer modeling. So this is really what what I think is the real value of genomic data. It's the fact that, there is a weak link between genomic variation and genetic load and this red list status. But precisely because there is such a weak link, it means that there is additional information in genomic data that can be used to help and to enhance the red list assessments. And this is not basically included currently in the red list because the red list doesn't really use genomic or genetic data. Well, you can use some genetic data in, for example, in category E, with Vortex, for example, you can make population viability analysis, but it is at a very basic level. We can now make much more advanced models to actually make real, very good predictions using this genomic information that we can get from reference genomes. And if you do that, what you can do is then you can say, well, I make a prediction using a computer model that is a forecast model, like we're using SLIM, for example, but you can use other software for that as well. But we're using SLIM to make these forecasts for prediction of the extinction risk or recovery potential of species 10 or 100 years in the future. And then you can use that as the target value that you train your AI model with. Because then you're not just saying, okay, I'm interested in the current threat status of my species. I can assess that with the red list. I actually want to know what happens in the real future. Is my population still viable in 10 or 100 years from now? And I think that is something to really include in the red list because it's something that we just don't know.
Yeah, sounds super cool. Just to recap for those of us that aren't as used to thinking about these things as you are, one of the problems in using genomic data in conservation is that there's this time lag between what's happening to the population now and what you see in the genome. So what you really need is a genome from 10, 100 generations from now, and we can't get that. But what we can get is an approximation of that future genome by using a forward genetic simulation model parameterized on the current genome.
Exactly. And then you can say, okay, well, I can simulate different conservation strategies, different management plans. I can simulate genetic supplementation or a genetic rescue program. Or I can simulate, well, some environmental change. And then you can say, okay, what is the impact of that future scenario on the population viability in the future, given the data that I have now about the genome and the other biological data of the species?
I think that an important thing to say before we build upon this is that you're trying to achieve this with a single genome for a species, right? To be able to assess a species with minimum sampling effort and sequencing cost, to keep all of that as simple as possible.
Yeah, so when you have a single reference genome, you can look back maybe 20,000 years to millions of years in the past. But anything that happened recently is very difficult to actually register. And for that, you need to have resequence data of populations, like 20 or 30 individuals. And then you can start to see, okay, in my whole population, I can now actually look at, rather than at coalescence of alleles, I have the nucleotide variation, I can look at the pattern in linkage disequilibria and the linkage between alleles at different genetic loci, because that is much more sensitive to recent population size changes. And by looking at this pattern of linkage disequilibria, you can reconstruct the recent demographic changes, like in the last 50, 100, 200 or so years, because those are the patterns that are captured by linkage disequilibria. And there's different software for that, for these different approaches. And combining those different approaches, yeah, you can start to reconstruct the entire demography from millions of years back right to now.
Uh-huh. It sounds great. So what's the status of this approach? Has it been done or is it theoretical right now?
So we are now developing these models, these SLIM models, and that's work I do together with Hernan Morales and a PhD student, also Tom Bearley here at the University of East Anglia. And Hernan has been driving this. He's from Copenhagen University, and he's been driving these SLIM models to really assess the extinction risk and recovery potential of populations using genomic data. And we parameterize these models using real kind of life history data from the species, but also the demographic trajectory. So there's really cool software like PSMC and GON and all kind of other software whereby you can actually reconstruct the historic demography, the population size trends. And we put that into the model, and we put also into the model the data of the genome. So basically the size of the genome and all kind of mutation rate and all kind of other things that sometimes the recombination map. And with that data, we can then start to simulate into the future what would happen to the population under a given management scenario, for example.
Uh-huh. And it's not just the positive effects of potential conservation management strategies, right? You briefly mentioned drift debt earlier. Could you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Yeah, so the problem that species are facing now, and a lot of these problems are very well recognized. Currently, species are facing habitat loss, climate change, emerging infectious diseases, invasive species, all kind of threats, external threats on the species that really are very well categorized in the IUCN red list. But on top of that, when the population is starting to decline, you also get this drift debt. Basically, you get the problem that is actually genomic erosion. You get a problem that individuals will become more and more homozygous for their genome. And that includes some of these bad mutations that are occurring normally in a low frequency in a population. So they're often in heterozygote condition. But then they become homozygous because you get inbreeding, you get drift, you get increasing frequency of some of these mutations. And once they become homozygous, then you get inbreeding depression. So on top of all those other external threats like habitat loss and so on, you get also this genomic erosion and the problem of loss of fitness, loss of evolutionary potential. And that's a real shitstorm, really, for a lot of species. We really have this problem, a lot of pressures, external but also internal at the genomic level. And that's something that we need to recognize. And we need to also assess this. And that is something that is not done yet by the red list. And that's why that people like me are trying to include genetic and genomic data in the red list. And I'm a member of this IUCN Conservation Genetic Specialist Group. A lot of people are trying to make this now happen. And it is something that, of course, is because the IUCN is a huge organization, that is not an easy task.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, there are also interesting new developments. So the IUCN has a couple of years ago in 2021 or 2020, they included this green status of species assessment. And basically, this is an assessment not about extinction risk, but about the recovery potential of a species and its conservation dependency and its conservation, basically how much conservation legacy, how much has conservation done for a species to bring it up where it is now, and how much is it still dependent on future conservation management, and what is its recovery potential. So this is really something that is an ideal framework, this green status of species, to also include genomic data in. Because that is really what we can do, of course, with the SLIM simulations, this evolutionary modeling. We can then make these forecasts to look at future population changes based on genomic data and on these kind of models. So I think that would be a very nice framework to use genomic data in, rather than in the red listing per se, these five categories I talked about, category A to E. I don't think there is room in that in those categories to include genomic data. But perhaps we could include this in this green status of species and put a framework in there to make those assessments using genomic data and computer modeling.
Yes, excellent. Something I was just thinking about there, and it gets to what you were talking about in terms of the different strengths of ecological and demographic versus genomic data. So a species currently listed as endangered due to small population size might see a significant increase in population size, and that would be seen as extremely positive from the perspective of the red list criteria. But that doesn't get you back genetic diversity, and the effects of any inbreeding depression or drift are still going to be present in the larger population as it grows.
No, I think that's a really good point, Mike. So one of the issues is that because the IUCN red list is so much focused on these kind of demographic, these population-based statistics, these metrics in their categories A to D and as well as E, that kind of takes away the fact that actually if a population has gone through a severe bottleneck, its genetic health, if you like, is much less good than before that bottleneck. So the population with a lot of conservation support may be thriving and may have recovered, but actually underneath the bonnet, if you like, at a genetic level, there is this still issues with genomic erosion, this high genetic load that was present as a masked load in the ancestral population, say all these bad mutations were at low frequencies in the population, so individuals rarely were homozygous for them. But now what happens when you've gone through the bottleneck, you've lost a lot of those bad mutations, that's great, but some of these mutations due to drift have gone up in frequency. And they therefore have a higher chance to become homozygous. Plus, of course, you get inbreeding. Individuals that are related to each other have to breed with each other because, well, there's not that many individuals left anymore that are unrelated. And again, that increases the homozygosity. So that converts this masked load into a realized load. And that reduces the fitness of these individuals. And that is on top of all these other threats, on top of the habitat loss and all the other threats. And of course, this might then be kind of covered up, if you like, by all the conservation actions that we do, with the supplementary feeding and all the other things that we try to do to help species recover. So it looks like they're doing well, and they are doing well if you look at population numbers. But underneath the bonnet, there's actually still issues. And that is something that we need to be aware of, because, of course, if we then downlist a species, so it goes from critically endangered to endangered or to vulnerable. For example, like the pink pigeon has gone through this beautiful recovery, if you like. But if that means that you therefore have less means and to help the species, then you are probably letting the species to its own devices, and maybe it's not fit enough to actually cope with that. And then you might actually be underestimating the long-term extinction risk to those species, because you're just simply basing it on the fact that there are so many of these individuals now around. But if they're all very similar, well, they're susceptible to, for example, an emerging infectious disease outbreak. And that could, of course, really dent the population and bring you back to square one.
Great. Of course, one way to try and combat genomic erosion in small populations is genetic rescue or some sort of breeding program. And I know that you're passionate about using genomics to inform breeding programs and science communication around that. You were talking to me before I got the chance to start the recording about a fun sounding project. So perhaps to end on, would you mind explaining that again so that everybody else can hear it too?
Yes, of course, Mike. So this is a bit of research that we've been doing together with Sam Speak, a PhD student in my group here at the University of East Anglia, together with Eddie Martin from the University of Edinburgh, who's done the sonification. And it's on the genetic load of pink pigeons in the zoo of Jersey Zoo, where we've been trying to find out which individuals are best mate pairs, if you like. So you can imagine that when you have founded a new population in a zoo, then these individuals had the founding population size wouldn't have been huge. You might have had 10, 20, 30 or so individuals that you have taken from the wild, maybe somewhere in the 1980s. And after a few generations, individuals become, of course, more and more related to each other. And zoos trying to minimize the amount of inbreeding in populations using pedigrees. But inevitably, of course, individuals become more or less related to each other. But also, and that is not captured in the pedigree, by chance, some individuals, even if they are related, may still carry the same bad mutations. Even though they might be related, they could still have, by chance, have inherited different mutations in a different genetic loci. And those would therefore be better matches than individuals that by chance have inherited the same bad mutation at the same genetic locus. Now, what we have been doing is we have been sequencing pink pigeons for Jersey Zoo, and we have identified their genetic load in ultra-conserved elements. So that's our areas in the genome that are highly conserved and due to probably strong purifying selection. And any mutations that happen in those areas are probably quite deleterious. So we've analyzed this genetic load of individuals. And what we've then done is said, okay, now imagine that we make a cross between these two individuals. How would their offspring look like? So we then used simple Mendelian segregation to say, okay, this is the predicted offspring genotype. And what we've done then is we said, okay, now let's try to visualize this for zookeepers and also zoo visitors. How would that individual perform relative to other individuals? So we used Für Elise from Beethoven, and we basically made a sonification of this tune, and then we detuned it according to the mutations in the genome of the offspring of this particular cross. So now you get then basically these dissonance in the melody, and you can then hear, okay, well, this is where a cross goes really wrong, and this cross actually sounds much better. So basically it's a way of illustrating, if you like, the genetic load that you expect to be expressed in the offspring of different individuals. And that is really so nice, I think, as an illustration tool, because then visitors in zoo can say, okay, well, what happens if you make these different crosses? These individuals, of course, they look the same. But by looking at their genome data, you can actually say these individuals are a better match than these individuals. And that is simply based on the amount of genetic load they share in their genomes.
Fantastic. I like that a lot. And it's super fundable, surely. I'm sure that if the zoos are on board, then people will be queuing up to give you the money. I'm very interested to see where that goes. So, Kok, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Mike. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That was Kok van Oosterhout, and you can find his recent perspectives article, AI-Informed Conservation Genomics, on the Heredity website at nature.com/HDY. Alongside a lot of other great research papers, and of course, all the information you need on how to submit your own work to the journal. Heredity is the official journal of the Genetic Society, one of the world's oldest learned societies, which is dedicated to the study and communication of genetics. I'm Mike Poynter. This has been the Heredity Podcast. See you next time, and thanks for listening.